History and Culture Podcasts are a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit pcntv.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Welcome to PCN's History and Culture Podcast. I'm Phil Beckman. This podcast series features interviews exploring Pennsylvania's rich history from the colonial era to industrialization, the Gettysburg Campaign to sports history, and from art to politics and more.
Christina McSherry, Executive Director at Historic Rock Ford. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Rock Ford in Lancaster County was the home of Edward Hand. Why was he a significant figure in history?
Well, Edward Hand was most prominently Washington's adjutant general during the American Revolution, but he was also a very fascinating figure in that he was a politician, he was a doctor. There's many stories we can tell about early America through looking at his life.
Well, let's consider Hand's military service, especially alongside George Washington. By the time he joined Washington's army, what phase was the Revolutionary War in?
In the very early stages. He actually had military experience. It might surprise you, he came from the British Army. He joined the British Army in 1767, and that was how he ended up in the United States, before it was the United States, of course, as a surgeon's mate. He left the British Army in 1774 and joined the Continental Army as lieutenant colonel in the 1st Pennsylvania. Thompson's battalion in 1775. Mm-hmm. So he was in the war from the very beginning all the way through to the end. He went to Trinity College, Dublin, became a training as a doctor. He was stationed at Fort Pitt by Pittsburgh during that military service. And then he left in 1774.
So why did Hand come over here?
From what we can tell, he was with the British Army, so I don't know that he had much of a choice. But when he left the British Army, he had decided he wanted to set up his own medical practice. And in the process of getting to Pittsburgh, he had made several contacts in Lancaster. When he decided to leave the British service, he decided, of course, not to go back to Ireland, that he liked Lancaster. He liked the contacts that he made there. He had letters of introduction, and he felt he could set up a medical practice there. Mm-hmm. So he left Fort Pitt and came to Lancaster to make that his home.
So he did, in fact, practice medicine when he got to Lancaster, at least for a while.
At least for a little bit. There was actually a very short time. He came to Lancaster at the end of 1774. He actually married in March of 1775. Mm-hmm. But by June of 75, he was already with the Continental Army. So he was not in Lancaster long after he set up his home there before joining the Continental Army. But then, of course, after the war, he came back to Lancaster as well.
So Hand got married not long after he got to Lancaster, right?
Not long
so
at all.
Tell us about the woman.
So he married Catherine Ewing, and her uncle is actually a prominent Lancastrian named Jasper Yates, who was a judge. And we actually don't know a lot about her. Unfortunately, we actually have no letters between the two of them. We know he wrote her frequently, but none of the letters from her to him survive. So she's a little bit of a woman of mystery. We don't have a portrait of her or anything like that. But we do know that she lived with her uncle, Jasper Yates, at the time that they got married, with her mother. And she has a brother as well. And then they set up house just about a block away from Jasper Yates in downtown Lancaster after they got married. And then, of course, she stayed there while he was away at war.
Mm-hmm. So who lived in the house?
It would have been Hand when he was home, Catherine. And then the children. Children came fairly quickly. Sarah Hand was born in 1775, so they got married in March, and she was born in 1775. Mm-hmm. But there also would have been several enslaved individuals as well. We do know, particularly supporting the household while Hand was fighting the American Revolution, there were three enslaved people.
What do we know about those slaves?
Yeah, so we know of a man named Robert. Now, Robert is a bit unusual because he also acted as courier. So in addition to supporting the household at home, he actually ran messages and supplies between Hand and his wife, and he was a teenager, approximately, during that time. Another enslaved individual was a woman named Susan, and she would have been helping with the domestic work at the home. She did attempt to self-emancipate in 1779, but unfortunately she was captured and returned. And we have records of her, the ads placed for her return. So we have a decent amount of information on Susan. And the one we know the least about is a child of about the age of 12 named Bette, who would have also been assisting in the household in Lancaster City during the war.
Let's talk some more about Edward Hand's military experience, especially when he met the commander of the Continental Army, George Washington.
Yes, so he actually may have met Washington even before that, because they crossed paths at Fort Pitt at one point. But we do know that Hand was involved in many of the early engagements of the war, including the Siege of Boston, crossing the Delaware, the Battle of Trenton. And then he was actually sent back to his old stomping ground of Fort Pitt. Now, out there, he was involved in the Sullivan Expedition, which was absolutely devastating for indigenous communities in the area.
Sullivan Expedition, tell me about that.
So that was an expedition that was a part of the Western campaign of the American Revolution, and it was directly targeted towards indigenous communities, supposed to be towards indigenous communities who were supporting the British, but that wasn't always clearly apparent, and it became very devastating for all the indigenous communities in the area, including destroying villages and basically their livelihoods and communities as the expedition went through. So Hand was a part of that. After his service in the West, he was brought back sort of to the East Coast theater of the war. And he was in Lafayette's brigade, so he knew the Marquis de Lafayette very well. And then the position of adjutant general opened up. And he was a rival with Alexander Hamilton to get the position. I mean, who didn't have a rivalry with Hamilton? But Hand beat Hamilton and became Washington's adjutant general. Now, they were very close friends from what we can tell, Washington and Hand. And they maintained a connection after the war as well, in that Hand was invited to the presidential residence in Philadelphia for dinner. He was invited to Mount Vernon for dinner, and Washington came to Lancaster on the 15th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence to visit the Hands, and actually made his only public 4th of July speech in Lancaster when he came for that visit.
Now, tell me more about the responsibilities in general of the adjutant general job.
Yeah, so it's it has an administrative role, but it's a very military-facing administrative role. So he works closely with the commander-in-chief to determine sort of what is needed for a battle campaign, what is needed as far as supplies, what is needed as far as soldiers. And his job is to make sure that everyone gets where they're supposed to be, that the allotted people and supplies are there. And then one thing that we see at the end of these campaigns is we see he's the one giving the reports of casualties. He's the one saying, okay, we lost this many men, this many wounded, this many captured. He's the one writing those reports to Congress at the end. So he's sort of doing all that sort of accounting and administrative work as part of it as well. He would have been involved in planning the battles, instrumental in planning the battles. We know for a fact that he was very heavily involved in the planning of the Siege of Yorktown. So the battle that ended the war, and he was at the surrender. There's a letter between him, I believe, and Henry Knox talking about what to do with the surrendered British swords after they were done. So it was a very military-facing role, but also a very important administrative role, very much front row seat to the actions of the war.
What do we know about Edward Hand's attraction to military service?
We don't know a ton about that. His letters are fascinating. They're our biggest window into his personality.
That's what I was going to get to, and letters went back and forth between he and his wife,
and he and Jasper Yates primarily. So his wife's uncle. The families were very close. So we sort of have two it's always interesting to look at when he's describing the same event to both people, because he takes a very different, I'm safe, don't worry, that was very close. So when he talks to Jesper Yates, he's like, that was a close one. And when he talks to his wife, it's fine. But he's describing the same
right.
event.
How much does he want to stress out his wife
stress
after
out
all?
His wife. So that's always interesting. His letters are incredibly descriptive in terms of what he's seeing and where he is. You can actually trace the entire war through his letters. Mm-hmm. Everything from read the Declaration of Independence in front of the army today. How was it received in Lancaster, to, you know, describing the we have a letter where he describes crossing the Delaware with Washington. But he doesn't always let anything, there's very, very little about letting it personal, mm-hmm. or his personal opinions about the military. The closest we have is a letter he wrote shortly after joining, that sort of gives the sense that because he decided to make his home in America, he saw a responsibility to the cause of American independence. He did seem to feel very, very strongly of that. That also comes through in his letters about the Benedict Arnold treason incident as well. He was very, very strong in his dislike of Arnold. So at least his service in the American Revolution seems to be very much tied to the cause, more so than service itself. We also do get a sense that he at times maybe got frustrated with military service because he wanted to be with his family. So we do have a couple back and forths where he came home on leave and Washington's finally saying, all right, you're done now, come back. He's taken enough time, come back to the army. That's about the insight we have as far as that.
Well, as far as any other possible insight is concerned, mm-hmm. into his relationship with his wife, did something come through in his letters?
Yeah, as I said, we have a very one-sided conversation between him and his wife, because we don't have any of her letters back to him. We have not found any of those.
We know that she wrote him, but we don't have those letters.
We don't have those letters. One thing that I was taken with is his involvement with the children. He's talking about the children. He's talking about the children's medical care. He's talking about gifts or getting a puppy for the children. So he seems like a very involved father, which I was struck with. But I also get the sense that maybe Catherine didn't write him back as much as he wrote her, because there are several letters that start with, I've written you a few times. Could you write back, please? we do get the sense that maybe he was writing her a bit more frequently than he was getting return letters.
So for how long did he go back and forth between Lancaster and the war?
Pretty much the entire war. We have several, and we can tell this because of a few children, as well as those letters back and forth between Washington talking about leave. Mm-hmm. So we do know he went back and forth. We do know he's had messengers coming back and forth. And we also know there was a lot of military business in Lancaster as well that he was involved with. Mm. Lancaster was a place where munitions were stored, and there's some letters with Henry Knox regarding that. But also, Hand was involved in the trial of John Andre, the British spy, and Andre was imprisoned in Lancaster, basically on house arrest during that process. So he was also doing some military things when he'd come to Lancaster as well.
So it sounds like Hand was often in the front row, occupying the front row seat for history.
Pretty much. He was there the entire war. Most of the events of the war that you could think of or that people know of, he was there for. And he was brushing shoulders with Washington and Hamilton and Lafayette and Rochambeau and all of these figures that we hear about for the Revolution.
What do you suppose his greatest military accomplishment was? What do we remember about him today?
That is a hard one. I think one that he had the most impact on would have been something like the Siege of Yorktown. Because of his position at that point, that's where he would have had the most impact. As far as the one people tend to notice about him is usually crossing the Delaware with Washington.
Right. Immediately that brings an image to mind, doesn't it?
It does. And that particular image, there's no key for that image, so we have no proof of this, but the urban legend, as it were, is the one behind the flag holding the hat is Edward Hand. Holding his hat on his head is Edward Hand. But of course, like I said, we have no proof of that. So I have to say, if visitors are thinking about Abraham, they often think about that crossing the Delaware. Mm-hmm. But as far as his actual historical impact, I think Yorktown would probably be where I'd fall on that.
Finally, the war ended. What did Han do then?
He came back to Lancaster. Now, he was still in the military. He actually his commission didn't end until 1800, so he was actually in the new United States military. But he came back. He practiced medicine. He also became a gentleman farmer, eventually at Rockford. Mm-hmm. So in 1790, they lived in their townhouse in Lancaster. He bought land outside of Lancaster and started the process of building the house. They would eventually move there in 1794. But he held a lot of government positions after the war. So he was in the first electoral college. He was in the Continental Congress in the in the 1780s. He was in the he helped write the Pennsylvania Constitution. He was Lancaster's chief burgess. He actually advocated, we have a letter where he advocated for Lancaster to become the capital of the country. Mm. And it's interesting because it reads in many ways the same things that we tout for like college admissions in Lancaster or people who, or tourism of like, it's close to Baltimore and it's close to Philadelphia and it's close to New York.
It has everything.
It has everything. There's a lot of different people here. He helped create the almshouse and hospital in Lancaster, the Turnpike. He was a founding member of that. He was a founding member of the and president of the Society of Cincinnati, so which is a fraternal organization for Revolutionary War officers. So he really had a lot of those foundational positions to the finding of the country, the founding of the country. In many different areas, everything from local government to national government to sort of the setup of institutions. But then he also was a doctor, and he was becoming a farmer, a gentleman farmer.
It's funny how a census with its mundane information can reveal interesting things. And I noticed that the 1800 census showed 14 people living at Rockford House. So 14 people in that house. Give me an idea of what life was like. And some of them were slaves.
Yeah, so so we have the 1800 census is actually one of our best records for that early time at Rockford. So we do know they moved there in 1794 based off of tax documents. And then in 1800, we get a little bit of insight into who lived there. Now, a lot of those people were family. So we do know Hand and his wife.
Still a lot of kids living there?
Yes. So actually, none of the children married until after Hand passed away, which is a bit unusual. The daughters were in their mid to late 20s by that point. When they moved into the house in 1794, there were seven children between the ages of 2 and 19. Mm-hmm. And they actually had eight children. Unfortunately, one of those children passed away before moving to Rockford. So that accounts for a lot of that number. In addition to that, we have three free white people. Two are women, one older and one younger, and one man. We believe that these could have been paid servants or something like that. We don't have names associated with them, and unfortunately, we don't have any other records. And then the other person who was in the house was a man named Frank. And Frank was living at Rockford, and Frank was an enslaved man. He is the enslaved man that we know was at Rockford. It doesn't appear any of the enslaved people that were at their townhouse in Lancaster came to Rockford with them. Mm-hmm. And Frank was their carriage driver. He did self-emancipate in 1802 and was successful. We believe he probably made it to Philadelphia is our current best guess. Mm-hmm. But at the time in 1800, he would have been their carriage driver. So he would have been maintaining the carriage house, the horses, and then driving the hands where they needed to go. From the home.
Well, let's consider the Rockford House today. Let's bring it completely up to date because the public can take a tour of Edward Hand's former home in Lancaster County. So briefly, give me a description of the outside of that mansion.
Yeah, so the mansion itself is a Georgian mansion. So we are on the National Register of Historic Places and in the National Building Survey, in part because of the connection to Hand, because he is an important historic figure, but actually also because of that architecture. It is textbook early American Georgian architecture. And what's absolutely remarkable is the house itself is 90% in original condition to 1794. There were no additions or anything like that placed on it. So the architecture that you see today as a visitor, the hardware, the doors, the windows, it is, like I said, 90% original. Pretty much the only thing that has been completely rebuilt is the porch that is on the back of the house. But the front of the house is your standard Georgian facade, so it has the symmetry. It has, you know, the fan window above the door. It has the brickwork has is fascinating because it has more expensive patterns where it would be seen, less expensive patterns on like the back of the house. But yeah, it's very textbook Georgian.
Well, let's consider some of the items within the house that have a personal connection to Edward Hand. And one of the items you have is his nameplate from out in the field. That's a special thing to have.
Yeah, so the nameplate is actually on a field desk. So the field desk is, it's a wooden box that would fold out and create a desk. And this was Hand's during the Revolution. So all of that administrative correspondence, those reports to Congress of casualties, those letters to his wife would have been written on this desk during the Revolution. And we're lucky enough to have that in
our
collection.
Maybe there are impressions in the top of that desk. Is that possible?
We haven't found any yet. You never know.
let's consider the what is called the formal parlor there. And just the whole idea of a parlor just sounds quaint in the 21st century, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So this is the, this would have been the most public room of the house. And the way we furnished the house, we're lucky enough to have several items from the Hand family. But of course, we don't have everything that was in the home. Mm-hmm. But when Hand passed away in 1802, a probate inventory was done of the home. And it basically gives us a listing of everything that was in the house in 1802. And because they were only there from 1794 to 1802, we can assume that those items were probably there for at least a portion of it. It's not like someone lived in the home or the family lived in the home from like 1810 to, you know, 1870, and 1870 wouldn't reflect 1810. We can say that that probate inventory is very reflective of the family's time there because it was so small.
After Hand died, Catherine remained there a couple years.
Till 1805, yeah. And then the eldest son passed away in 1807, and then it was sold out of the family. But the formal parlor would have been the most public space. It has the pianoforte. It has the most lavish decoration and furnishings. So this is where they would have entertained. And those furnishings that we have, we've tried to match to that probate inventory as much as possible.
Tell us about this chair.
Yeah, so the Hand's chair, this is on display in the study, and this has come to us through a Hand descendant. Now, we do believe it was custom made for General Hand. We don't have a lot of information on it, but if you see it in person, and maybe you can even see this from the image, it's a bit long in the seat, especially compared to other chairs of the period. Hand was 6'4". So we
tall man had long legs.
Yes, and you picture him next to Washington, both of them being very tall in the period. So we believe that was custom made for him and a bit long in the seat to accommodate his height.
How about the dining room there?
Yeah, so the dining room, this would have been the other most public space of the home. And again, done by the probate inventory. Interpreted using the probate inventory for us. But there's a couple really special things in this room that I do want to point out. One is the window in the kitchen, in the dining room, actually still has two of the children's names carved into it, which is pretty special.
Sure is.
The eldest son and daughter carved their name onto the window. So that is still there. The other thing is the portrait of George Washington. Now, this one is a replica, but we do know that a portrait, probably a Gilbert Stuart portrait of Washington, was hanging in the home when the Hands lived there, again, showing that relationship with Washington, as well as sort of the patriotism of the early Republic. And another thing that's pretty special about our interpretation is we do change up our table, the food that's on our table. Every item on the table is representative of a period recipe. And it gives us a way to talk about the people who are cooking, who are the other people in the household other than just Hand.
So your display gives us insight into their diet, too.
Into their diet,
didn't occur
too.
To me.
Yeah, and we change that every month or two. And we have a wonderful volunteer who actually makes all of our faux food based off of these recipes. Mm. And I think that's something sort of unique, a unique insight that you can get in the way that we interpret the home.
So when people take a tour of this house, Christina, they can get up close to these.
Yeah, so our tours are, the house isn't as big as you would think, especially when we go through how many people lived there. It's a three-bedroom home with parents and seven children. But our tours are fairly intimate, so they're no more than 15 people usually, mm-hmm. so you really can get into the room and see what's there.
So tell us about the kitchen. That's got to be a busy room in a house with a lot of people.
Yeah, so this kitchen would have been the heart of the household, even if Hand and his wife were not down there frequently, if at all. And this is where Frank would have interacted. This is where those servants would have been working. But there are some interesting things about the kitchen. The kitchen is largely very well preserved. We still use it. We have an 18th century cooking reenactment group. Group that called Warm Hearth Committee. Mm. They demonstrate cooking once a month in there, and they try to make the recipes that you see on the dining room table so that there's that continuity of how it would have been done. But they could have gotten food from Lancaster. It was a market town, Philadelphia. It would have been bustling. But there are some, one of the interesting things that you can see in the image is the what's called the spit jack. Mm-hmm. And it was a time-saving thing. It sort of works like a wind-up toy, and it's on the sort of the mantle, you can see it there, and it's actually connected to a weight. And you can wind it up, and it's connected to a wheel on your meat spit. And when it's all wound up, it turns your meat spit for about 20 minutes, and then you can wind it back up, and it'll turn it for another 20 minutes so that you didn't have to be turning your meat spit. And that's something that we know they had based off of that probate inventory.
Let's take a look at the bed chamber at Rockford. Mm-hmm. Christina, is everything in that photo authentic?
Yes, and actually more authentic than you would realize.
Oh? So
those bed hangings and curtains actually still exist. They're in Winterthur Museum's collection in Delaware, the hand bed hangings, and they have been meticulously reproduced for our interpretation. So not only do you see period furniture and the things that reflect that probate inventory, mm-hmm. but we can actually say exactly what pattern was on the hand's bed hangings. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty cool.
Now, the last picture we're going to look at is especially interesting to me mm-hmm. because you said you don't have a lot of yes. personal information about Catherine, but yet you have something as intimate as an article of clothing.
Yes, so we don't have any of her letters to hand. We don't have a portrait of her, but we do have one of her pieces of clothing. We have her mm-hmm. dress. If I had to pick a favorite piece in our collection, this would be it. And what's interesting is the fabric is older than the dress. The fabric is imported from England in 1750 or 60, and the dress was remade to be fashionable a few times. Mm-hmm. The view of it that you see today reflects approximately around the time the hands got married in 1775. So it gives us some insight into her clothing, her size and stature. It's something very personal.
Last question, Christina. When a visitor completes a tour there at Rockford, what do you hope they go away with?
We hope they go away with a better understanding, not just of Hand, but of early America and early American culture. We always talk about these folks that are doing the big things, the things that Hand did. And Hand's life between the doctor and the immigrant, he's, being an immigrant, the farmer, the politician, we have so many windows and avenues to discuss early America and early American culture. Mm-hmm. We also have the enslaved people, the servants, the tenant farmers. Rockford is really a great place for those conversations, combined with the John J. Snyder Jr. Gallery, which opened in 2021, and that collection.
Christina McSherry, Executive Director at Historic Rockford, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PCN's history and culture content, like the interview you just heard, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. Explore other documentary programs, event coverage, and a lot more. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.